This edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 23rd of April, 2012. Hello and welcome to the 28th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, the theme is collectors and collections. The Culture Show has a wonderful collection itself of original papers, vintage press releases and promotional records annotated with dusty post-it notes. But sometimes we're told that this isn't a collection at all, merely a very untidy desk. But in solidarity, we'll explore some other people's collections. And a good place to start is with the director of the V&A, Beth McKillop.
The confident, expanding, emerging societies of the world are collecting avidly, and we, in our perhaps more mature way, having been around for 150 years, still collect with passion and with purpose, we hope.
And we'll sit down with a big man, the collector, photographer and philanthropist Jean Pigozzi, to talk about his quite amazing and pioneering collection of African art.
People go to Alcohol Anonymous or Drug Anonymous or... But there's no collecting anonymous, which I wish I knew where it was. I would like to go there.
Plus a collector of rare Arabic music in Paris, an amazing accidental gallery in a North London home, and a girl in Melbourne who collects paper bags.
They're connected to a memory and some really insignificant memories, like a really great sandwich or something like that. I just think that they're beautiful objects as well. That might sound crazy.
That's all here on the Collections edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First, though, a song, of course, and keeping in the collection theme, this is one of my favourite songs and something I'd never have heard if it weren't for Rough Trade's compilation collection CDs. This must have come from a trip to Notting Hill's Talbot Road some years ago, and this is Demetrosen by Lilliput. Still sounding as fresh as it did all those yonks ago. That was Demetrosen by Lilliput, and that's from Rough Trade's Post-Punk Volume 1 collection. And we'll start this collection edition of The Culture Show with the sort of thing you think about when you think about collections, art and artefacts. And who does that sort of thing better than the V&A? That's not a rhetorical question, by the way. You're welcome to shout in and say. But managing a collection as vast and varied as that of London's South Kensington Institution is a monster job made light by many hands. Some of the best two hands in that business are those of my next guest, Deputy Director of the V&A, Beth McKillop. Beth, welcome to The Culture Show. I always kind of think that the V&A is a bit like an iceberg. You only see a fraction of it actually in the museum and in the international exhibitions around the world. Can you tell us, first of all, how many artefacts and objects does the V&A possess?
We've got about 220,000 museum objects. These are things that we can put out in our galleries. But if you then go back into the back of house and look at all our libraries, print rooms, collections of textiles and other fragile objects, the total's much higher. It's about 2.2 million objects altogether. So it's a very, very large collection.
So you yourselves at the V&A are a collection of terrible hoarders.
Well, we've been around for more than 150 years and we have collected a very wide range of things. We were the first museum to be interested in photography, for example. Mm-hmm. But we also look at furniture. We have a fantastic, huge collection of ceramics. And lots of people will also know us for sculpture, for our wonderful British miniatures. And I could go on and on.
And it is the sort of eclectic nature of this collection at the V&A, which I guess it's obviously famous for, but it must make it the devil's own job deciding what to put in front of people's eyes and what to keep in the catalogues downstairs.
Well, it's a good point, but I guess that people working in museums never run out of great ideas for new displays, new galleries. It is the devil's own job to decide what to put out, as you say. But on the other hand, sometimes we have to kind of rein people back because we are dying to share the collections with more and more visitors. But in museums, as in so many other parts of life, I guess less is more. And so we are very, very thoughtful and considered as we put out our new galleries. I mean, one, for example, that we'll be opening later this year is a furniture gallery. And we would love to show everything we've got, but really it would not make a fantastic display and help our visitors to understand the incredible work, care, craftsmanship that goes into furniture all around the world. And so it is a matter of choosing and displaying and using design.
I wanted to ask you, you know, obviously with the furniture show that's coming up later in the year, that's something obviously that presumably has a lot of old stuff in it, but there's a lot of contemporary stuff. It's something that possibly is very contemporary in people's minds anyway. But let's take it back to the beginning. Where does most of the older stuff in the collection, pieces from, you know, ancient everywhere, where did that come from in the first place to end up in South Kensington?
Well, to really understand the collections, you need to go back to the mid-19th century, to Prince Albert, I think, who is the name that links us to our past. And at the time of the Great Exhibition in Hyde Park, there were works of art and designed objects, furniture, ceramics and so on, textiles from all around the world. And they were brought to Britain to show people, I think, excellent manufactured objects was the phrase at the time. And it's a very quaint phrase in a way. And yet it has a sort of power even for today, because in this new consumer world that we live in the 21st century, human beings still need to enjoy the things they have, the clothes they wear, the seats they sit on. And that's the V&A's purpose. It's about design. And our early collections were designed things which were considered at the time to be fine and worth copying. And nowadays, when we look at some of these mid-19th century objects, I don't think we altogether agree with our predecessors who chose them. But it is very thought-provoking, and it still is the seam that runs through our work in collecting. We try to pick out what's excellent and outstanding. We try to talent spot the up-and-coming designers and artists who are going to make life more pleasurable and more visually stimulating for everyone.
And obviously the idea of a collection seems to me, you can correct me on this, whether it seems to be a very Victorian impulse and a Victorian habit, the habit of collecting, of building, of putting the things that were in the Victorian age in a historical context, putting them as a comma in the big canon of art and design and artefacts. Is that sort of fair to say? I mean, obviously a lot of the stuff is very, very old in the V&A.
I think what's really admirable about our Victorian predecessors was the curiosity they had and the open-mindedness to all different traditions. I mean, for example, we have a fantastic carpet in the V&A, the Ardabil carpet, and that object is with us because curators back then really admired Islamic design, the sense of pattern and repetition, and they weren't closed-minded. They looked for what they could bring into the collection, and they brought this extraordinarily beautiful and enormous mid-16th century carpet, which now dominates the space in our Middle Eastern Islamic art gallery, to the museum. So I really feel that sometimes when we look back in the Victorian period, we think of the more insular and perhaps sort of narrow-minded features of some parts of Victorian intellectual life. But as far as the V&A is concerned, those pioneering collectors are the ones who set the scene for the collecting impulse that goes on until today. Nowadays, of course, it's more difficult to collect on the same scale. The market is very, very buoyant. But, you know, if you look around the world, what you see is collecting as a passion in societies that are doing well. And the confident, expanding, emerging societies of the world are collecting avidly. And we, in our perhaps more mature way, having been around for 150 years, still collect with passion and with purpose, we hope.
And maybe I can ask you about acquisitions. Obviously, we can talk about the furniture. We can talk about the furniture show that's coming up. The current show is the British Design 48 to 2012, which is obviously a big Olympic hit show. Have you acquired new stuff, both of these shows, or is a lot of it loan structure now?
Well, both, actually. And we do try very hard to acquire in tandem with the exhibition programme, so that we can go back perhaps in 20 years' time or in 50 years' time and recall that a particular piece came into the museum because of the moment of a particular show. So, for example, during this British Design Show that we're seeing just now, there's a fantastic sort of very, very light, almost frothy evening dress by Hussein Shalayan, which we commissioned and got for the collection as part of this project. We've also got a terrific architectural model of the Aquatic Centre at the Olympics by Zaha Hadid Architects, and things like that will be like a moment in the museum's life, which is recorded by adding a significant object to the collection. And they are one part of our collecting. We also look at a wide range of more traditional art forms, from stained glass through to marble sculpture, through to textiles from China, from India. We are very wide-ranging. One of my own particular favourites among the things we've bought recently is a fantastic 15th century Chinese bronze Buddhist figure, which sits in our Buddhist sculpture gallery, a particular interest of mine. I could go on and on.
We've probably got time for one last question, Beth, and that is about the acquisitions. I wonder, do you have to have a sort of family conference and decide, what you can afford and what is relevant? And obviously, I wonder also if you sell stuff on, if stuff ends up that possibly was in Italy or was in China or wherever it was, whether that ends up going back there when you're talking about money.
Well, very much so. We do, as you say, like a family coming together. We think long and hard about how we can buy or persuade others to buy for us or to give us the things that we think would really enhance the V&A's collections and our ability to teach about art, to show about art and design, and really to strengthen the collections. As a big national museum, we don't, in fact, often take things out of the collection. We lend a great deal. You'll find V&A objects, particularly in country houses and in other museums around the country. We also tour exhibitions a lot, but we don't really often remove objects from the collections.
That's good. See, I told you, we started off saying you're a collection of inveterate hoarders. You've proven it to be true.
Not hoarders, but collectors. Thank you.
Beth McKillop, Deputy Director at the V&A in London. Thank you very much. Now to North London, where we found a real hoarder. A man of taste and learning, sure, but also a man with a proper compulsion to collect. Tim Sayer, a journalist without a fortune to his name, but possessed of a where there's a will, there's a way attitude to amassing art, invited Katie Bilboa and I to his home, which is jam-packed with painting, drawing, prints and sculpture. There's an Anthony Caro, crowded by a dozen other pieces in the loo. There are pieces of found art in the porch. Unless there's a book on a shelf on the wall, there is art. We asked this North London Aladdin for a tour around his cave.
I started, I think, in 1962 when I was 17. I paid 10 shillings, i.e. 50 pence, for a portfolio of prints in a junk shop in Richmond. And I think they came from some posh family in the area. And I've been framing them up ever since, over the past 45, 50, whatever years it is. I bought, I think, a John Nash in the late 60s from the Royal Academy. And then there was a bit of a lull. And then I think I had a girlfriend who was a collector, so I thought, I think I might compete here. Certainly some things supersede others, and I bring things home, and if there's no room, something else has to go out. I have a friend over the road who very kindly lets me have a room for storage. So anything that gets superseded is booted out and, I'm afraid, wrapped up and put over the road. I buy mostly from galleries. I still buy from artists, but mostly it's galleries. I'm friendly with quite a lot of the artists, and certainly friendly with a number of dealers in London. I regard them as good friends. I have one dealer especially who I've been buying from for 25 years, and his mum, who ran the gallery before him, used to say that what I paid them every month, they could have their lunches out of that. And her son, who now has taken over the gallery, said he would much prefer to sell to someone like me than people who come in and just look around and say, oh, we'll have the lot, or just exude money, and prefers somebody who has to struggle a bit. And my taste over the years has changed from sort of modern British, and then it changed and tends to be abstract these days, because I find more interest in abstract.
Did any of the rooms in your house sort of describe a timeline through your taste?
I think they're all a complete muddle. You just never know what you're going to find anywhere. I just have to say, well, that one up there came from last year, this one came from this year, that one came from 10 years ago. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason in the way it's hung.
We looked at some of your new purchases on your desk, and they're covered up by tea towels to stop the cat from putting his critical eye on things, right?
His critical paws and teeth, actually. anything that could be chewed. the cat will have a go at. Yes.
Right. And does it? What sort of taste does he have? Does he scratch more modern British, or does he have a go at the abstract?
Totally indiscriminate. Absolutely, totally.
Walking up the stairs, it seems like a bit of a tour through abstraction, doesn't it? Is there any reason why these are here? And do you pause on the stairs and look at things?
It doesn't stop me looking at them. I do pause, as it were, with the cat, and look at them.
And what about these heads? One looks Asian, one looks African. Where are these from?
The one on the left with the feathers comes from Papua New Guinea, and the one on the right is in a very lightweight wood, comes from northern India. They're both, I think, early 20th century.
And where do you buy something like that? Did you go and come out from a temple with something under your arm that you shouldn't have, or are they a gallery purchase?
They're both gallery purchases. I leave it to other people to do the travelling, and I just buy up what they've stolen.
Let's go into the sitting room.
You go first.
As I said, talking about going to a gallery, and most gallerists like it when they consult a friend like you rather than someone that wants to come in and find something that fits exactly over their mantelpiece. Having said that, what's over yours?
It's a painting called Dog Eat Dog by an artist called Martin Hawke. And I bought that from a gallery about 10 years ago, not because I thought it would fit or the colour would go with anything, purely because I liked it. It's a very strange painting. It could be a battlefield. It could even be a rough sea. And as the light changes, you see more things come out of it, and sometimes things go back in. Occasionally you can see a staircase sweeping up to the left. Whatever you do with the light, it changes.
Do you have people come to see your collection other than us with our nosy microphone? Do you have other people come and give them a tour of the collection?
I always regard this collection as here for as many people to look at as possible. I have friends in galleries, in some of the national galleries, and they come around, artists come around, collectors, friends. It's always here to be seen. Everything I can remember where I got it, and nearly all of them I can remember why I bought them, how I felt at the time, and the thing is, they're still there, so I must still like them. If I didn't like them, they wouldn't be there.
Do you still get that thrill that you had sort of almost 40 years ago when you bought those first prints?
Yes, exactly. It still moves me. Yeah. And I think, excellent, I've got something I can take home in a week or two. And then, of course, the problems begin with where it will go. Something might have to be chucked out. I move things around sometimes because one picture may not go up against another one. And as for framing, this big picture we see, this big abstract we see on my left, the artist brought it round. I bought it from him, and he carefully made an enormous frame for it. And as soon as he was out of the front door, I had the frame off it, because it was hideous. The poor man's dead, so I can say that.
So here we are. So you've taken us to the top landing, Tim. What can we see up here? A painter at work across the way.
It does look like a big easel, but he's actually a window cleaner. That's by an artist called Denise Nemtsov, who I'm still in touch with, which I bought about nearly 30 years ago. That and the one below it of people digging the road is one of the few narrative paintings that I've still got, and those will remain because I'm very fond of them.
Are we allowed to go into your bedroom and see some of these sculptural pieces as well?
Shall I just pull up the blind before we start talking, and we can see a bit more? That sequence over the bed, those 10 vacuum form prints by Richard Smith were done in the 70s, and I've collected those over the past 20 years. I didn't buy them all in one go. The green one on the bottom row was the first, and then I kept finding others, and so that now is the complete series. I think it's called the Logo series. When I saw the green one, the first one, I liked that because it's a 3D image. I like the colours, I like the abstract concept of it, and I found out there was a series and thought, well, go and find some more, and gradually I did. And every single one I'm very fond of, and I think they look absolutely tremendous, forming a whole wall on their own.
Is there a hierarchy of paintings in which room they sit?
Absolutely not, because behind me now, just there, is a Gerhard Richter, which is the most valuable picture in the collection, and it's just sort of tucked away in a corner in the bedroom. I try not to buy anything my wife doesn't like. There is one piece in the front room that she loathes, but where she tends to sit, she can't see it, so I don't care.
And we're going to continue the tour. You've told us that the loo's a kind of chamber of curiosity as well.
Let's try that, shall we? Right, come on in. I'll stand here. You're going to shut the door.
I'm going to shut the door. So we are in the smallest room in the house, literally.
We certainly are, yes. It's slightly uncomfortable, the three of us. I mean, my knees are banging against the lavatory pan, but I'll be all right.
There's a standing and a sitting way of presumably enjoying art in the loo, Tim. What are we looking at now? Now that we're standing, I'd like to point out.
Well, I'm standing sort of looking across the loo bowl rather than sitting on the lavatory or even standing doing something into it. So I'm looking at my latest purchase, which is of a nude by Jean Marchand, which we're going to take off the wall because it is, as you will see, double-sided. And I picked that up from my framer yesterday, and he's done a magnificent job. As you see, there's another figure recumbent on the back.
So is this a study on one side and the finished article on the other, are they two?
I think he was probably short of paper.
Well, that's apt, as we're in the loo. And and what are the other...
The other highlights.
Bog highlights.
Yeah, the bog highlights, if you... Well, at eye level, so if I was sitting on the loo, I would be able to see this Anthony Tapia's print. Below that is a rarity, which is an Alexander Calder drawing of a cowboy lassoing a horse. And below that, there's a beautiful photograph by a Japanese artist called Asano.
And I'm intrigued about these, Tim. What's this at the top?
The top one, which looks like a series of high-heeled shoes, is not a series of high-heeled shoes. It's a painting by an artist called Prunella Clough, who died about 12 years ago. And I've got, I think, 15 of her works, various periods of her life, from the mid-40s until, well, late 1990s.
And so describing this, it looks like they look almost like cut privet hedges in the shape of high-heeled shoes.
Indeed, with
something floating, a sort of...
A mesh
sort of UFO floating over the top of them.
Exactly. Maybe we should pop into the kitchen, get out of this somewhat cramped.
Let's leave the loo.
Oh dear, we're locked in. you see the kitchen's full. Everything's full. There is a letter from my bank manager dating about 20 years ago saying, don't you think you really ought to somehow get a grip on your collecting habit? And that's all typewritten. And at the bottom, he's written in his own hand, it's a humdinger, isn't it? Humdinger of a letter. Don't take much notice of it, but I had to do it.
And the collecting instinct is obviously an interesting one. It's a sort of addiction, isn't it? Would you admit that?
Totally. I am negotiating with a public gallery in southern England in the hope that I will leave it to them because we haven't got any children. In fact, we have no relatives of a young age. So when we go, I want this to end up somewhere where people can still appreciate it. So negotiations are continuing slowly. Very slowly.
And that was Tim Sayer giving us a rather charming tour of his extraordinary collection at home in North London. More hoarders next. Why? Because you're listening to Culture's Collective Special right here on Monocle 24. After a tune, we'll be chatting to super collector Johnny Pigozzi.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. Then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
You're tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24, and still to come, in part two, we visit a paper bag collector in Melbourne, speak to arch art collector Jean Pigozzi, tune in to a collector of Arab music in Paris, and attend the opening night of a Milanese show fusing dance and design, which is much better than it sounds, honestly. Thanks for listening. We'd love you to stay doing so. Before that, though, a song on the theme. This is pretty damn charming. It's called Collection of Stamps by those Rye Swedes. We're from Barcelona. And from Sweden, confusingly enough, that was We're from Barcelona with their song called Collection of Stamps. And you're listening to the Collector's Edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. All right, we all want to know how and why one of the most famous art collections came into being. Jean Pigozzi is a bit of a legend, isn't he? Multimillionaire, dater of beautiful women, philanthropist, large liver, photographer and art collector. Our man in New York, Barrett Austin, met the main man.
My name is Jean Pigozzi. I'm very old. And I was born in Paris. My parents were Italian. I went to school in France. And then I went to Harvard in America. That's it. The collection was started about, 22, 23 years ago. I was a small collector, like a bad dentist from Minneapolis. You know, I had a little Clemente, a little Warhol, a little this. The names were right. The pieces were not so great. I was speaking to my friend Charles Sachs, and he said, you know, your collection is idiotic, you know, you waste your time. I said, okay. And then there was a show in Paris, it was called Les Magiciens de la Terre, and I went to see it on the last day with the around 4:30 in the afternoon. The guards sent me to move, as they wanted to go to the cafe and get drunk. And I saw a few amazing African things, which I had no idea. For me, African art was these, you know, what you see at the Metropolitan or any kind of British museum, a piece of wood or a dog with nails or these gold masks, which was relatively not interesting for me. But I didn't know that in Africa at this time they were doing incredible paintings and drawings and videos and photographs and all that. So I saw these things, a few examples in this show. And the day after I called Bobour and I said, you know, what are you going to do with all these things? It was called, and they said, well, actually, I said, I want to buy them. I said, you can't buy them because a sponsor is going to get them all. But he said, if you want to meet the curator who put the show together for Africa, here's his phone number. So I called, and the guy was called André Magnin, and I met André. And I said, André, what are you doing now? He said, nothing. I don't have a job. I have nothing. So I said, André, okay, I want to hire you. And we started 22 or 23 years later. Now we have built the biggest collection by far of contemporary African art. And I hope it's the best one, and it's vast, and it's been shown from Bilbao to pieces at the Tate, to pieces at the Metropolitan in New York, to Houston, to all around the world many, many times, and this is it.
And let's talk a little bit about the works that you've collected. What does the collection consist of today?
The collection, if somebody didn't know it came from Africa, it's exactly the same collection of somebody would collect, you know, contemporary art in New York, and it has paintings, and it has sculptures, and it has photographs, and it has videos, and it has 3D models of things. So there's no real difference. The only difference is that all the art was produced by people who lived in Africa, who were alive when I bought the piece, and they had to be black. So I have no white Africans in the collection, which is, and no diaspora, because I had to limit myself. So, you know, there's a huge number of African artists who are now living in Paris or in New York, but my collection was very focused on only collecting artists who lived and were black and lived in Africa.
In which nations in Africa have you been most captivated by the work?
First of all, for full disclosure, I have never been to Africa. Okay? So André goes to Africa. I've never been, but every piece in the collection I have chosen. So it's not that André chose them. We chose them together. The most interesting nation for some, I don't know why, is Congo, the ex-Zaire. And it seems to be one of the most prolific countries. But, you know, they have things from Benin and Mali and Kenya and South Africa and Ivory Coast. I mean, it comes from a bit everywhere.
And let's talk a little bit about how the collection's been curated over the years. How many people do you have involved in the process?
It's an incredibly complicated process. First of all, we have to ship it from Africa, and I keep my paintings in a place in Le Parfum in Geneva. Somebody who knows how to make a box, how to send it, okay? Or they roll it. So half of the time, they roll it, and it's too tight. And when it arrives in Geneva, it's all glued together because the painting wasn't dry. Or if they make a box, the box is going to break. Then it arrives. Then you have to photograph. Then you have to restore it. Then you have to put it on a stretcher. Half of the paintings are not square rectangular, so the stretcher has to be done in a special way. Then you have to store it. Then you have to do a bit of research. Then a couple of years after, you have to restore it another time because the painting they use is not good. So something that you would buy for 10 ends up costing me perhaps 50 between the transport and the insurance and the storage and the restoring. And I have, you know, a couple of people, I have three people working on this thing. I mean, it's a crazy thing to do this collection. It makes no sense whatsoever. But, you know, once you're addicted, which I am, to collecting, then you're stuck.
And lastly, I wonder, would you say that collecting is an obsession of yours?
Well, I think it's worse than an obsession. I think it's a disease, you know. People go to Alcohol Anonymous or Drug Anonymous, but there's no collecting anonymous, which I wish I knew where it was. I would like to go there. It makes no sense, you know. You collect and collect and collect, and eventually I'll be squashed by a bus. And the three charming ladies from Sotheby's or Christie's will come to my warehouse, and they will disperse this collection, which is completely crazy. But that's the fate of many collection, and it's a, you know. But some people collect shoes, and other people collect Ferraris, or they collect houses, or they collect wives, or collect children. I collect art.
Telling it like it is, that was Jean Pigozzi catching up with our man Barrett Austin in New York. And of course, it's not just art that people collect. There's the weird and wonderful too. There's something to be said for people that see an intrinsic beauty in something that we all screw up and throw away. Paper bags, you know, plain old sandwich bags. The paper bags books come in, your usual run-of-the-mill paper bag. Have you ever taken a second to look at its creases, the design on the front, the way the shopkeeper lovingly folds over the top to keep your purchases safe and fresh? Well, printmaker Rhea Green has. For the last 6 years, she's been collecting these papery treasures. Melbourne correspondent Irene Scott went to check out the paper trail.
Hi, welcome. Come in. They're through here.
Hi, my name's Rhea and I collect paper bags.
What is it about the paper bag that first got you?
I guess I was getting lunch from the same cafe for too long and they just gave me this really standard white paper bag and they were getting crinkled and they were just really beautiful objects, which is why I kept them. And then I found myself accidentally collecting paper bags. So it kind of grew out of that. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was just something that I can't throw out now. I just can't let go.
So we've got two quite large suitcases in front of us filled with paper bags. Mm-hmm. Take me through some of your favourites and the ones that really stand out for you.
I guess the older ones are really special, and I guess the ones that have been given to me and have surprised me. So this one is from a lady I used to work with, Matilda, and she had kept this for obviously, you know, over 20 years, a Hallmark bag, and the characters are really iconic of the time and it's just beautiful. And, you know, the wear in it, you know, you can see that she's kept it and sort of looked after it, which is a strange thing to do for such a piece of ephemera. And it's also inadvertently a sort of an archive of, well, I guess I don't think they'd call it graphic design at that time, but that sort of thing. So I haven't looked through this for a long time. You have to look like a fool a lot because you'll get given, you know, whatever you've bought. And I'm like, oh, can I just get an extra paper bag with that? And they sort of look at you and, but, you know, you get used to it. It's one of my favourites. Here we go. Two of my really good friends have done a year of travel all over the world. So they were slowly collecting paper bags for me from different places. I don't even know where that's from. That one's from Spain.
It's an interesting collection because it's something that most people, and the way it's designed, most people would see as entirely disposable. The point of the paper bag is what's in it, not the bag itself.
Yeah, exactly. Part of the reason I've retained so many of them is because, they're connected to a memory. And I think, you know, some really insignificant memories, like a really great sandwich or something like that, it sort of works on a few levels for me. I just think that they're beautiful objects as well. That might sound crazy, but I'm trained as a printmaker and I think printmakers sort of have this understanding and appreciation of paper. You know, you have to put boundaries on it because it is a fine line between collector and hoarder. I'm aware of that. I collect sick bags off aeroplanes, which is really funny because if I'm sitting next to a stranger, they're always quite worried. If I'm grabbing them within the first 5 minutes of me getting on a plane going, oh my God, she's going to throw up. She's definitely going to throw up. Vacuum bags, even sanitary products, bags that, you know, hotels and stuff provide. So I've had to kind of take those on the sly as well. You feel really naughty.
And I guess there's something about a paper bag. You know, often if you buy a book, it'll come in a paper bag. Or if you're on holidays, the postcards come in a paper bag.
Exactly,
or it's generally, except for maybe your sandwich, as nice as it sounds, it's generally a nicer niche, you know, luxury that you're buying if it comes in, something like that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and I've got a few record bags and, you know, they're really exciting things that come in. And
that's from France.
I think that's a wine bottle, which I just think that that's such a beautiful bag. It looks like an etching originally. You know, it's such love. Oh, Puffin Books, that's an older one. I like that one.
I like it that in your collection you're not snobby about it. It's not like, no, I'm only going to collect the ones that have the perfect illustration. You're happy to have, like the one that's in my hand at the moment, a bag for garlic chicken balls that just says, got balls.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's great that it can be that lame and it can be shown against the French wine bottle that's, you know, beautiful and elegant. And yeah, I like them all creased as well, you know, the sense of time and passing over to, you know, from one hand to another and that sort of thing. You know, it has a history, it has a story, and it carried something as well, which is really significant.
How important to you is this collection? If, say, there was a house fire, would you be going for these suitcases to save them first?
Yeah, I would be.
Talking to Ria after the interview made me think of my own slightly odd paper collection. I collect Love Wanted ads, you know, the ones in the newspaper, just a couple of lines of text and a code you enter to contact them. Now I'm sounding like the crazy one. It all started with one I found about 5 years ago that read, "Alcoholic deadbeat pensioner seeks woman for relationship or whatever. Call me." Pretty brave, hey. I guess it just got me thinking about the stories behind these ads, like who is that guy that markets himself like that? I just think it's weird and kind of interesting that in the age of online dating, some people still choose to use the newspaper to find love. And it's interesting how people choose to use those couple of lines of text. Like this one. Lady, Chinese government job, seeks nice, reliable man, age flexible. Really? That's what sums you up? That you've got a government job? You're not into long walks on the beach? You're not looking for love and support in a relationship that will take you through the ages? Really? Anyway, they're interesting. And each one with just three short lines of text hints at a story and generally raises more questions than it answers. And I guess that's why I like them. For Monocle in Melbourne, I'm Irene Scott.
And that was Irene Scott, formerly speaking to, bag lady, Ria Green, and then spilling the beans on her own collection of lonely hearts. She's a lonely hearts fetishist. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's the Collector's Special, and you're tuned into Monocle 24. We're off to Paris for a musical collection after this.
At 1800 hours London time, tune into Midori House, the hour-long show that lifts the lid on the daily workings at Monocle's HQ. We delve deeper into the stories of the latest issue of Monocle and catch up with our editors and correspondents on the road as they put together the next one. Tune in at 1800 hours London time and finish the working day with Midori House, live every weekday.
And right now you're tuned in to The Culture Show with me, Robert Bound, here on Monocle 24. And now we're off to Paris, where Alexander Orn met up with Lebanese singer Yasmin Hamdan to talk through her collection of old Arabic records and also hear how that fine collection of rare stuff influences her own work.
Hi.
Come in.
You have been collecting old Arabic records from the 50s and the 40s. Why do you like collecting this?
It has to do, it had to do with the reason why I sing today. I started singing in English. I'm Lebanese, so I'm a Lebanese artist, singer. And when I started in the end of 90s, beginning of 2000, I was singing in English in the beginning. And then at some point, I was living in Beirut, and I discovered, I rediscovered, because I was in a way disconnected from this music because of civil war. My family was not living in Beirut. When we came back, and after I started singing, I rediscovered these artists, old artists, and the first one was Asmahan. In a way, it helped me to find my own way back to something that had to do with my Arabic identity. So I started by listening to Asmahan, and then by hearing songs of Asmahan, I started to research some other artists. And since these artists were also singing in musical comedies from the 40s and the 50s of Egyptian movies, etc., I started to track them down. So I came to Abdul Wahab. So Abdul Wahab was this other guy I completely fell in love with, and I started to collect all his songs. And then I started to really want to go further. I started to want to find out where it started, how, what were these artists, what were they doing. And at that time, like in 2000, let's say, it was not so common to have all these songs on MP3s. So what happened is that I had dealers in the city in Beirut. Like, so I would go to from a place to another. Like, I had this guy, I would go and tell him, look, I want something really rare. I'm ready to pay a lot of money for that. This guy would go to radios, like the national radios and stuff like that, and would find old recordings and put them on tapes. Then I found out that there was a very tiny place in Hamra with a crazy guy completely in love with Arabic music, with all, like, completely living in memories. He doesn't live the times we were living in. So I discovered these people all around in the city. And then I would go from a place to another, and I started to collect these songs. And this is how, when I came to Paris in 2002, I had all my bags were full of tapes. Like, I had maybe 3 t-shirts and 2 pants, and the other stuff was only tapes and CDs.
What is it about this music that you like?
It depends. It's variable. Each artist I like, or it's like I fall in love with the song, but also with the singer. Eventually, it helped me at first to connect with the past, and also it helped me, I don't know, developed an ear. I cannot even imagine my work without these people. Like, even now, when I re-adapt one of the old songs, like in my new album, I'm singing an old song that was sang, I think, in the 30s or 40s by a very famous singer called Leila Mourad. First time I heard it, I fell in love with it because it's a very complicated song. And my desire to bring it back to a modern time, and in a way to readapt it, to reappropriate it, comes also from the difficulty of how can I still remain honest with myself and sincere with who I am, the times I'm living in, and at the same time respectful and truthful to the song.
How did you get into it?
It was like when you fall in love, this is what happened. Like, I was in university, in school at first. Then when I really discovered these songs, I was in university, I was studying psychology. So at a certain point, I had the choice or to continue and do psychology or to be a singer. And I decided to be a singer and a composer and to be a musician. So these songs were, in a way, my education. This is the education I got. So this is why I started collecting. And this is, I'm autodidact. I did it my way, and my way was to listen to these people. And this is why I started collecting so much and so many. And also, I was curious. I was so curious. Each time I would discover an artist, I would be really mesmerized. And also, what is incredible is the parallels that you have, let's say, in the old Arabic music coming from Egypt, for example, and some old Indian music from the 30s and the 40s. So each time I go to a country, I also collect old songs from each country I go to. I try, not always, but when it's exotic. So it's, for me, it's part of my education. It was a normal process. I haven't even thought about it. It was obvious for me that I had to connect with this past. I had to find out about all these artists and singers and have them with me.
Is there one song that really means something for you?
All of them. All of these songs mean a lot. So for many reasons. Let me make you listen to the first song I started to sing. Ya Habibi Ta'ala from Asmahan, and this is the first song that made me enter. It made me start my collection. It made me start singing eventually in Arabic. It made me start, you know, want to dig more into that. Ya Habibi Ta'ala al-haqi shuf illi ghali min ba'dak sahrana min wajhi banaqi khayala.
And that was Yasmin Hamdan talking to Alexander Orne in Paris about her collection of 50s and 40s Arabic records. And you should tune in to hear a bit more from Yasmin. We're going to try and get her in to the Culture Show for a session as well. And that's pretty much all we have time for this week on the Collector's Edition of The Culture Show. I hope you enjoyed our North London Aladdin, our Aussie Bag Lady, Yasmin Hamdan in Paris, and Jean-Pierre Gotzi, of course, in New York. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and this show was mixed beautifully by Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week. This one's from the finest compilation series to appear in record shops in recent years, the Ethiopiques series of Ethiopian music from the 60s and 70s, compiled in Paris by Francis Falchetto. This is Almayua Eshetti, getting old James Brown, singing Chero Adegi Nin. Take it away, Almayua, and thanks for tuning in. Tarikun Dezino.